The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
When someone is actively funding a market, actively participating and saying yes, and then doesn't show up, they chose not to. So the repo market interventions, they continue to suggest that the surface level calm that you have in the credit markets is ignoring something just under the surface, issues which at least a few banks are more sensitive to. So if you're in the habit of lending overnight and choose not to, what are your reasons?
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, as a reminder to the listeners, at the end of each year for the last 11 years, we have asked them to send questions in so that we can have end of year, early beginning of next year, 2020, answers to those questions. So we would encourage you to send as a listener to info@McIlvaney.com, I-N-F-O at McIlvaney, M-C-A-L-V-A-N-Y.com. Send us those questions, and we usually try to address just about everything that we're sent.
Kevin, it's a little bit like getting ready for a race. I get a little nervous because each year there's a little bit more, I don't know. I experience a little bit of anxiety when we get the questions in because every year I think they've gotten harder and harder and harder, right. And I feel less qualified to even take a stab at answering them.
Well, we have very deliberate listeners. It's interesting, Dave, how engaged the listeners are. Sometimes you were just talking about somebody you were visiting with the other day who knew more about what you had said on the show than you probably remembered.
Right. So somebody who's been listening for years and years and years, and it's been a part of their educational process, and the accumulation of that information all of a sudden makes the questions harder and harder and harder. But yet, send them in, and at info@McIlvaney.com, we'll do our very best over one show or two, depending on how many questions we get.
Another thing we've been doing for 11 or so years is meeting early in a restaurant here in Durango. They open it up a half an hour early for us. We sit back at the back table, and we discuss the day before the recording, some of the things that are on our minds. It doesn't always show up in the recording, but it's amazing how it smooths things out as far as what we're going to talk about. But, you know, last night we were sitting and talking and just saying, gosh, the news cycle, it feels like shock therapy. You know, shock therapy is like zap, and then you get this little bit of a release, and then zap, and then a little bit of a release. But don't you feel like we're just hearing the same thing over and over and over and over and over again, and they're expecting reactions in the markets and reactions in the voting booths? Getting tired.
Yeah, well, there are times when keeping up with current events, political affairs, market dynamics, it feels like observing an unhealthy codependent relationship, because there's a cycle to it. And there's a similarity. There's a pattern of saying this and that, doing this and that, and the reactions that follow. There's hope that, you know, things are going to change and that this time will be different. And then that hope lasts for a little while, or at least until you kind of re-enter that negative part of the cycle all over again. And, you know, the weeks wear on, and again, it's on again, off again, posturing with Donald Trump and Xi Jinping.
Oh, it's the China thing over and over and over.
It's on again, it's off again. The inquiry aimed at Trump's ouster, taking him out of office. At a certain point, there's, again, it's a feeling like the news cycle, I don't know, maybe another way of looking at it is like being snared in a sticky spider's web. Hmm. There's the content, which is there. And, you know, I've done enough interviews with Bloomberg and CNBC and Fox. You know, the content is produced. It's curated. You have a production team who's deciding what they want to talk about and who they're going to talk about on those particular things. But when I say it's produced, it's crafted. Right. And the crafted content is driven not just by a point of view on a particular issue, but more fundamentally by assumptions that tie to a particular philosophy. If you're trying to figure out like what news organization is going to present a certain set of facts in a certain way, then you're talking about the assumptions tied to a particular philosophy. And I guess that's why it feels like a captured conversation, sure. A news cycle that feels a bit like a spun web. In the end, the stickiness of the messaging is so that the viewers can be drawn in. They know who their audience is, given that sort of philosophical or worldview perspective. And in the end, they're trying to market products, and advertising is the primary moneymaker. But on that issue of philosophy driving the interpretation of events, that's kind of the news filtration and representation process.
Well, it's funny you mentioned products. And, you know, as you know, when I was going to school before I interviewed here 32 years ago, I was a toy store manager. And there was a change in the entertainment and the toy industry about that time, back in the 80s, where you started seeing movies and television shows coming out to actually market products. So you had shows that were actually toys that kids could go buy and large product lines that they could buy. And, you know, I think the same thing now is products that are marketed in the market itself. You think about this news cycle, Dave. Bloomberg is producing an awful lot of the news, but they also sell the program, the algorithm program for Wall Street to trade on that news with keywords. So it's sort of a vicious loop where let's go ahead and make the news, let the algorithm react, and then let's change the news, let the algorithm react. It's sort of dehumanizing.
Do you think Michael Bloomberg would be interested in influencing the outcome of the election?
Oh, not at all.
Owning one of the primary business news outlets, do you think there might be any influence in terms of articles that are allowed to run? Any
Maybe he should start voting booth algorithms as well. Maybe he could do the counting there.
Well, this last week, my son and I discussed the difference between a social democracy and republicanism. Mind you, nothing to do with the Republican Party. There is a big distinction there between republicanism and the Republican Party. But you're talking about a political philosophy which was refined in Rome. It evolved further in Britain and then was repopularized following the Enlightenment by Montesquieu, French philosopher, and then here in the United States by Madison. Mm. And it centers on ideas like the rule of law being of priority. There is an emphasis on rights, but more on the responsibilities of citizens.
Well, and that's the key, responsibilities. People don't want to take responsibility right now. They want to be comforted.
Yeah, a week or so ago, I had several friends, Bob and Matt, thank you very much. You're keen to remind me that our system of government, this was the system of government put in motion by our founders.
A republic.
That's right. So officially, we are a republic. When I describe the USA as a democracy, I do so as an observer of what we're shifting to. Mm-hmm. And more it's towards not just a democracy, but a social democracy with an enhanced role for the state. The state is to act as guarantor for the programs, the collective redistribution of wealth in keeping with a set of values, which are expressed by a cohort, the loudest, maybe even the most prolific set of voters at a particular point in time. So what we are and what we're becoming is not what we were or were intended to be. Mm. I think that was the clarification I probably needed to make a week or so ago in talking about our democracy. My point is that to a degree, now the news feels familiar. The pundits seem repetitive and the messaging is somewhat monotonous. But it's consistent with an operative political philosophy.
You know, we were having a discussion this morning before we came into the studio, not you and I, but one of the other guys who I work with here. And he said, you know, we live in a period of time where the victims are becoming the heroes. And I hadn't really thought that through. But if you look at society right now, you were talking about social democracy versus actually republic, which republic requires responsibility. The heroes of republic were people who stood up and took responsibility for what they did. We now seem to be moving socially to where it's victims, victims, victims crying out, and they're sort of the heroes. And, you know, you're talking about the news cycle, but I think we see that as well. You know, we joke about snowflakes or what have you, but how often are you actually seeing people being given credit for taking responsibility for action, you know, either sinking or swimming based on their actions?
But again, public policy circles, they're coming around to the issues which represent the values of our day, whether that's a priority on global warming and climate change, or whether that's a priority on, you know, re-equalizing the world. There's been income disparities, there's wealth disparities, the difference between the gaps between the rich and the poor are growing. And now there's new initiatives. Powell is talking about how monetary policy could be used. Neil Kashkari at the Minnesota Fed is talking about how monetary policy can be used for redistribution of wealth.
I mean, socialized just, redistribution.
Yeah,
that's the difference between that and republic or responsibility.
Yeah, it's just, I guess, when I look at the news, is there anything new to discuss?
Right.
No.
Sometimes no.
kind of same song, different verse.
Right.
But then again, of course there is. Yes. I mean, we've got home sale figures, which are very positive, just out. And we've got GDP figures, which according to GDP Now, the Atlanta Fed, that's their production deal. They're on track for a much more positive fourth quarter.
It's amazing what $60 billion a month does, Dave. I mean, we're getting some nice positive numbers for what?
Yeah, no, and I read in a fascinating article over the weekend, and it was being argued that we should, and this was kind of an argument pro modern monetary theory, we should be giving money to the poor because it increases economic activity.
Right, and we can print that because we don't actually make it. We don't make it in revenue, so we'll just print it.
And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, no duh. Of course it does. What do you do with money? You go spend it.
Right.
And it's going to have an ancillary benefit to those in your community because this is what we call velocity. Hmm. You take $1 and spend it, and the person who receives it from you is going to end up spending some portion or all of it. I mean, so yes, there is an economic benefit or boost.
Just like there was in Germany in 1920, 21.
That's right. So on the front edge, you have economic benefits, but on the tail end, you've got something which can be cataclysmic in terms of its consequence. And so you've got employment figures, which they're still positive. You've got Chinese industrial production figures. They were not positive. They were off almost 10%, which really does suggest that global demand is still under the gun. And all of these things, they're important. They're important signals. Now, you look at them over and over again, and you talk about them over and over again, and they're different every time you talk about them. Why are they still important? Because they send indications of change, and it's change, the change that they suggest, which is so important. Doug Nolan, we talk about this on a weekly basis, multiple times a week on our team. He's one of the leads for our wealth management team, manager of our market short product. Small shifts in the myriad indicators we watch, these are the telltales, which in retrospect, they hold prognostic or predictive value.
Okay, but let me ask you, because the central banks are so integral at this point where, you know, in a way, they're like training wheels for the market. Remember when your kids were learning to ride a bike, you put training wheels on. And the training wheels allowed that bike not to fall over. And so they could actually think that they were riding a bicycle. That's not a bad idea. But if you put the training wheels back on the bike later, are you really riding the bike the way it should be ridden, or are you relying on the training wheels?
Yeah, that's right. So there's always news to consider, but the dominant themes continue to repeat. Trade conflict, required central bank accommodation, you know, what is it going to take to extend the asset price inflation? But, you know, central is the role of central bank monetary policy.
Right, the training wheels.
They're creating a perfect backdrop for speculation and for leverage to grow. And we have seen this sort of a cycle before, where leverage grows to heights that are rarely seen in the history of finance. And that is still a dominant, and yes, it is a recurrent theme. Nothing matters more than that. But of course, it all matters. It just, again, you look at it over and over and over again, and you think, does this really matter? Yes, it does.
Yeah, I'll tell you, one of the more humiliating things as a man is to not be able to get a fire started. Okay, when you go gather wood, we've both done this, I'm sure, at times, where you gather wood, you get your tinder together, you light the fire, and the wood's just a little too moist. And so you get your fire starter out, or you start cheating. Okay, you pour that fire starter on the fire, and you know, you've got a certain amount in the bottle. And I will tell you, Dave, there have been fires where I've used pretty much the whole bottle and still not gotten the fire started. I wonder, with all this liquidity coming into the markets, are we actually just trying to start a wet wood fire?
You know, you look at the consequence of QE, and you're starting to get some feedback from various economic powerhouses in Europe saying, look, QE is not helping us here.
Right.
It's not helping us. And then they're talking about the long-term deleterious effects. Yes, it's great in a crisis, but is it so good as sort of an ongoing thing? And that's, I think, what's in question now. You've got stock markets this week, which are, you know, let's face it, they were off to a rough start straight out of the gates. Trump was getting things kicked off with the announcement of metals tariffs on Brazil and Argentina.
Hmm.
And then adding to downside pressure was a lower than expected ISM factory number. By midweek, we had Donald raising tariff stakes with France, which is an inconvenience for
you're
those of you.
You're a champagne drinker, yeah.
When it comes to New Year's, I don't look at sparkling wine as quite, no, it's not my preference.
It's going to be more expensive this year.
It's an inconvenience for any of you who prefer champagne to sparkling wine for New Year's, $2.4 billion in tariffs to the French. So then you've got, following shortly thereafter, comments that Trump made from London, that it might be better to, it was funny because literally if you look at the sequence of comments that he made, it's, we got the deal done. The trade deal's done. You know, we're just working on the details now.
No, it's shock therapy.
It's almost wrapped up.
Yeah.
And then literally, it was almost like something snapped. But, you know, frankly, we'll probably wait until after the election. Probably better wait until after the election for a trade deal with China. And this is why it appears like an abusive relationship. It's terrible. Now it's better. Now it's terrible. No, it's all better now. And this back and forth, it's like the yo-yo effect in the market. We're down. No, we're up. No, we're down. Now, who's holding the string of the yo-yo?
Do you think, though, possibly that's part of how Trump negotiates, is to keep everybody on edge all the time?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so from his standpoint, he's going from win to win. I think there's some consequences, relational consequences, but his tweets and announcements are enough to keep things on edge, which is to say, what he wants to say is sufficient to direct the markets up or down. Because keep in mind what's behind the scenes. You've got algorithmic headline reading manic reactiveness, which is driving 70-80% of market volumes these days. Hmm. Algorithmic reactions or overreactions to headlines. And in turn, will his tweeting and sort of feeding the machine, if you will, with the headlines that he wants, is that enough to force the hand of Jerome Powell?
Well, and see, that's an interesting thought. To me, that's really an interesting thought because Jerome Powell, like most Fed chairmen, try to maintain, at least publicly, some sort of distance from the political spectrum. Trump has been very, very vocal about Powell. There's times when he's praising him, more times when he's criticizing him. But it seems that Powell, you know, if you're having to try to manage price stability and you've got actually a number of tweets that are coming out and changing perception of the people without you actually managing the money, it's a weird thing. You've got a lot of waves rippling the pond.
Yeah. No. And so last Wednesday, where were we on the trade bill? Final stages. It's done. Consider it done. Well, but then, you know, we've got the Hong Kong thing. The bill just passed to support the pro-democracy demonstrators, as they've now been tagged. So that notwithstanding, you know, Trump's in the marketplace, is asking Powell to lower rates. He's asking for lower value of the dollar. And this is the issue. Perhaps the power of the tweet is now how he intends to coerce Powell to get on board. No trade deal. What does that equal? It equals market volatility.
Hundreds of points of drop.
And that's not rocket science, but too much volatility and the Fed must act. Is this sort of a grand scale game of chicken? I mean, chicken between, pick your parties, Trump and Xi? Is it the game of chicken between Trump and Powell or between Trump and the whole world?
Well, and if it all works, it might actually benefit us. But if you think about these dials, Dave, there's large, large dials that are being turned. We've got trade deal dials. We've got liquidity in the market dials with the Federal Reserve. These are large dials that are actually very, very dependent on public perception. And if that changes or something happens that is outside of the control of those large dials, unintended consequences will show up all around the world.
So we go back to where we started, because we actually had futures which were suggesting a positive open on Monday. And then, you know, right as the market's getting opened, we've got the Brazil-Argentina tariffs. In the case of Brazil and Argentina, the pillar of the argument was massive currency devaluation.
Do you think that was purposeful, though? I mean, do you think they purposely, Argentina, devalued their currency?
You know, look, Argentina's experienced a 60% loss in the value of its currency this year. And, you know, if you look at sort of the 30% the year before or 35 or 40% the year before that, I mean, it can hardly be argued that was a deliberate choice. You've got a currency in free fall. And so you look at the Argentine peso and you can almost view it as like the stock of Argentina. It's being sold off because the market looks at the new management, which is now.
It's the old management.
It's the old management, right. Which frankly is bad news for the company and, right. And the future trajectory of the company, or in this case, the country. So Macri is out and a puppet Kirchner government is back in, which is, again, it's like the CEO or the board of a company. Are they choosing to lower the share price or is this the market reacting? And I think it is. The market signaling the election results as a catastrophic mistake.
Well, we were there
from an economic perspective.
5 years ago, we were there, and 40% inflation was the rate at the time, and then it increased from there after we left.
That's right.
You know, but remember, we had to operate in what they call, they don't call it the black market, they call it the blue market, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we have seen the effects of the Kirchner government, but isn't it interesting that people still voted socialism back, Dave?
Well, it's not a surprise because people, when they're uncomfortable or insecure, want someone to come up with big picture solutions.
The victim is the hero.
So to try to contain the flood of money leaving the country in Argentina, you know, you've got an exaggerated currency slide in effect now. You've got capital controls, which are back in place. And so I think this is a part of what we're seeing here is Trump liked Macri. Trump doesn't like Kirchner or the new president, Alberto Fernandez. And so this is, I guess, speaking of capital controls, there was a critical article from the Financial Times over the weekend. And it's the Financial Times, I forget the exact title, Turning the Tank or something like that. And it's basically the IMF moving the opposite direction from what is known as the Washington consensus, basically that the free flows of capital are beneficial to all the countries who have sort of lowered the barriers to entry. So if you allow for the free flows of capital, if you don't have tight restrictions in place, then you see economic growth and benefits. So the IMF is flirting with research, which supports a directional shift to 180 away from open markets and towards broad-based capital controls.
Right.
I mean, and it's like, we've been here and done that. This is just reaction to the fact that we do have income disparities and wealth disparities, and it's being viewed as, you know, globalization's to blame. Actually, what's to blame is central banks holding, you know, at bay sort of a natural market function.
Well, and Carmen Reinhart told us that to be able to really control things, you have to have captive audiences. Capital controls, that's exactly what we're talking about. If you were a Venezuelan over the last few years and you wanted to get your currency out of the Venezuelan markets,
good luck.
You couldn't. You just basically failed with the Venezuelan currency.
Right. So we should never forget that capital controls are like a Berlin Wall. They're not there to keep others out, but to maintain that captive audience.
Right.
And not only is this idea of a return towards broad-based capital controls reflective of the end of globalization, that's a long-term thematic for us, and we've talked about this many times with our guest Harold James, but it underscores and reinforces economic nationalism. So on the one hand, you've got academics who will criticize nationalism in the political sphere, but by moving in the direction of economic nationalism, again, a rhetoric of us versus them, is dangerous.
Right.
And I think what they're doing will ultimately serve as a veil covering over the detrimental domestic policies, including inflation and massive economic redistributions. So the IMF policy recommendations, I think, should be very carefully scrutinized as we go forward and as they further develop, because this is not an accidental thing. You do the quote unquote rigorous academic research to figure out if an idea can be presented or is a plausible policy solution or recommendation, and then it's recommended to politicians, and then it becomes legislation. That's kind of the nature of how an economic think tank or a group like the IMF, you vet an idea that way and then promote the idea, and then the idea becomes the world as we know it.
I think it's important sometimes. I even get confused if I'm not stopping and listening when I hear, you know, you talk about the end of globalization. Globalization is a good thing where currency can flow between countries. That's not the same thing as globalism. What we're really talking about here is, as you shift control to larger and larger entities, okay, we've talked about the illumined few, you know, who are ruling the world. Well, that's globalism. That's not something that we're for, but globalization is very, very important for the free market to function. Capital controls keep that from occurring. And tariffs, I mean, let's face it, the tariffs that we're talking about, that also is the end of free market globalization, or at least working that direction.
Yeah, I think Brazil is a little bit different than Argentina. Brazil was also mentioned earlier this week, and Trump continues to like Bolsonaro. They have some personality similarities. But here's the reality. There's an election priority that has more urgency even over that friendship. You've got here in the United States, the Farm Belt. in the audience in Iowa. So we're less than a year from the election. And I think it's fair to say that everything crafted, whether it's by Trump or by the Democrats or by Schiff, you name it, it has a singular purpose. And the purpose is election 2020.
That's another one of the big dials, Dave. Okay, so let's say you're trying to now turn up votes here in America. There are unintended consequences worldwide, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, so it shows well to a particular audience, an Iowa caucus and the Farm Belt. But the misstep in this case, Brazil, is that while Trump could arguably win some benefits on the commodity front, his audience, undoubtedly the Iowa farmer, he's driving two partners directly into the arms of the Chinese. The commodities produced and exported from these locales are in high demand in China. And improved trade with the Chinese serves to shift balance in trade and in power relations. And so I think what we see is a short-term political benefit, November 2020, with a very long-term cost to multilateral trade and sort of healthy geopolitical relationships.
So let me quiz you on something, because you said it was two things. Okay, we talked about the commodities from between Brazil and China. But we've talked before about Russian supply of Europe, you know, Germany getting half of their oil from Russia. That's a big, big dial as well. And how would you like to try to build a pipeline from Russia through Siberia to China that's two-thirds of the length of the entire United States, and to do that in rapid fire and start flowing oil, not to the west like what we're used to, but now to the east, the Chinese, that you were talking about driving them into Chinese hands. Where the energy flows, that's where the politics flow.
Yeah, and it's gas pipelines. And I think the big headline here is that our foreign policy in the present moment is helping to strengthen the cooperation, not between us and other nations, but the cooperation between other nations. And it's undercutting our role in the global economy, and I think ultimately as a geopolitical power. And on that front, you know, you're hinting at the Power of Siberia pipeline. That's what it's called, Power of Siberia. That's the name of the pipeline. This week, it was initiated, the first flows of gas from Russia to China. It's the largest pipeline project in Russian history. Gazprom is very proud of having covered 3,000 kilometers across Siberia to the southeastern border of China. What they call the deal of the century.
4,500 kilometers is what the United States, if you want to use kilometers since they're using it here, 4,500 kilometers is the United States, coast to coast. We're talking a 3,000 kilometer pipeline. Now, I'm not sure what state that would be to what state, but that's huge. But the bigger issue, historically, we'll look back and we'll say, look at how history changed when the oil started flowing east.
Yeah, and I $55 billion is no small project. That's a significant investment. It's no accident that the project was launched immediately following the US-EU sanctions on Russia over Crimea. And so as relations with Russia have deteriorated, and this is both a European issue as well as a U.S. issue, Trump has attempted actually to maintain some civility with Putin. Of course, he's gotten criticized, and we've got all the imbroglio related to Russian interference in the election and all of that. But Trump, I think, has seen pretty clearly that if the U.S. and EU relations with Russia are not improving, then they're probably devolving. And that's, in fact, what's taken the place. And there are no power vacuums on the world scene. So to the degree that one was being created through the devolution of the relationship, China's more than happy to fill that.
Okay, so we talked about the length of the pipeline, but why don't we put it in perspective how much oil Russia is supplying to Europe versus what the increase is, or what percentage does this play for China relative to the European flow?
Yeah, Xi Jinping has set a goal of $200 billion in trade with Russia by 2024. And this is one of the things that gets them a long way towards that. And so, yeah, when you look at the gas that flows in the pipeline, it'll carry roughly 20% of the production quantity currently supplied to Europe.
Yeah, so, and I had said oil too. This is a gas pipeline.
Yeah, the Russia to China flows are targeted at 38 billion cubic meters per year versus 200 billion that flows to Europe at present. And they already have two more pipelines being discussed to bring an additional 30 to 40 billion meters of gas production per year from Russia to China. It's the erosion of diplomatic ties. It's the loss of leverage in existing relationships, which is one of the characteristics of the Trump era foreign policy. We're getting better deals done. And that, I don't disagree with that. We are, in fact, increasing our slice of the pie. Mm-hmm. But the consequence of deglobalization, which I'm not pinning on Trump, I'm merely suggesting that he's adding momentum to that existing trend. The consequence of deglobalization is that we're talking about a larger slice of a smaller pie.
One of the major themes over the last quarter, Dave, is all the signals that we've been talking about that reminds us of 2007, 2008, right before the crash, and also 1999.
In 2000.
And, you know, whether it's mergers, acquisitions, insider selling, corporate buybacks, but ETFs, something $6 trillion flowing into ETFs?
Yeah, it's a product that barely existed 20 years ago. Exchange-traded funds hit the $6 trillion mark. And so you've got, you know, in recent weeks, new records for stocks and new records for, if you think about ETFs, it's kind of a grab bag of purchasing for investors. You don't really know what you get in the bag. It's the mystery purchase. And I guess what investors need to be reminded of or be cognizant of that indiscriminate buying with the grab bag approach using ETFs, it begets greater degrees of indiscriminate selling at some point.
Well, it's passive investing until all of a sudden it's panic. Okay, so passive investing works. So you can use that P word, passive, and you're passive. And then all of a sudden you wonder why there's no buyers for the passive investing funds.
And of course, if you took the time to look inside the grab bag, what do you find? One of the big things is Apple.
You reach in and get an Apple.
Apple right? stock is worth more than all the large cap U.S. energy stocks combined.
Wow.
And that wasn't always the case. And you might recall our comments on Apple a few weeks ago. It's a company that has a total market value of over $1.2 trillion.
And that's worth more than all the large cap U.S. energy stocks combined.
Right. And so we're talking about the value of the company has increased between 75 and 80% in 1 year. To $1.2 trillion, right? So how do you extend those gains into 2020? Could you say, oh, well, we're just going to do the same thing for 2020. Let's see another 75% increase in the value of Apple stock. That'll take it closer to a $2 trillion company.
Sky's the limit, Dave.
Yeah, is that possible? Well, someone ultimately says, look, 75%, 80% in 1 year, I'm going to take some profits. And the issue here is that in this case, it's detrimental. It's detrimental to most of your major indexes.
That's the passive panic.
But you go back to this comparison between U.S. energy stocks and Apple, and it's like a ratio. There's two components. In this case, you have the ubiquitously owned Apple stuffed in every large cap ETF, all the primary indexes, and you have component number two, energy, which has been sold off aggressively to levels that suggest we no longer need fossil fuels. It's a part of our history, not a part of our present or future. Which is not the case, whether you like it or not. Drove back from Thanksgiving from Texas and had to fill up with this stuff called gasoline.
Oh, I thought you would fill up with an Apple iPhone because, you know, the capitalization is so much more for Apple than energy stocks. Can't you put an Apple in your tank?
Well, I mean, the Democrats think you can eat them. So maybe there's more that we can do with Apple products than we know. Oil is up for the year. Natural gas is down. Lila Murphy, a part of our team, has said energy in general is priced for a nuclear winter. So, you know, if you said, well, how would you guys bet? Our bet is that energy outperforms Apple over the next 1, 3, or 5 years.
Yeah, so what Lila's talking about is everything's dead. No real need for energy. So it sounds to me like energy is a deal at this point.
Yeah, investor appetite is virtually nothing. If you took a contrarian view to that, you'd say Apple got a little overpriced at 75-80% move in 1 year. Current market valuation, you know, with its current cash, it's probably more of a bond play or a call it a preferred stock play than even an equity play.
You know, in 1987, mergers and acquisitions were huge. Okay. And then in 1999, before the crash then, mergers and acquisitions were huge. We saw the same thing in the mid-2000s before the crash. We're seeing a lot of merger mania at this point, right?
Sure. Tiffany's gets bought by Louis Vuitton, LMVH. Schwab is buying TD Ameritrade. I mean, fascinating that last week, in 1 week, we had $70 billion worth of deals done. Look, we're still on track for a sub $4 trillion number for the year, a very high number. I forget if it's 3.4, 3.6.
Is this how you hide a drop in earnings? Do you just go into mergers and that type of thing? Because we've talked about the earnings turning down.
I think that's the critical point here. And as Winston Schwa has said at TrimTabs, you've got these flurries of M&A, which tend to peak, that's mergers and acquisitions, they tend to peak around market tops. He says that companies attempt to grow, to buy growth rather than grow companies organically. And so that you're right, Kevin, in terms of, you know, trying to create something out of nothing. If your earnings are in decline, can you pretty up the pig, so to say? And yes, we've had previous M&A peaks, 1999 to 2000, 2006 to 2007. And as we've discussed, it's the corporate earnings growth, which is already reversed, already moved into its own version of recession. And now companies are choosing to get creative. It's a corporate version of extending the trend, just like the central banks have done that in other ways. And in more and more cases, they're using stock for those purchases. So if your stock share price has gone to the moon, then you use that instead of cash. With stocks trading near record levels, it's the new money for the purchase of other assets. That's becoming more and more common.
Well, and a couple of weeks ago, you brought up Walgreens. Okay, so we don't want to take that off the table. That's still a $70 billion possible deal.
Right, $70 billion if it goes through, private equity deal, largest ever leveraged buyout initiated by KKR. Now, I think one of the things that is very important to know is that you're already seeing a shift in the leveraged loan market. Nice. And the leveraged loan market is where you go to get a lot of money for private equity deals, and you're already seeing some fundamental deterioration in price shifts, both with the cost of borrowing going higher and the value of existing loan portfolios moving lower. So I think really, if we look back in time, if we get out onto the horizon, 3, 6, 9 months, and look back in time, that KKR deal for Walgreens will probably be one of those major market top indicators.
Well, and you mentioned a lot of money going into leverage, but where's that money coming from? Because like a broken record, we're going to continue to talk about $60 billion a month in this QE4, whether they want to call it that or not. Plus, we have the repo markets that are providing liquidity. It doesn't seem like the banks are wanting to participate much. The banks have liquidity. They're just not putting it out there. We're having to, as the taxpayer, or however you figure it out with the Fed.
Yeah. So if you extend, you know, as we said, by the end of January, over $11 trillion in liquidity to the repo market in aggregate, banks in aggregate, you know, going back to September and when the repo issues started to emerge, banks in aggregate had sufficient liquidity to lend into the overnight market.
But they didn't show up.
And this is, I think, when something doesn't happen, you have to recognize that the choice was involved. When someone actively is funding a market, actively participating and saying yes, and then doesn't show up, they chose not to. They chose not to. So the repo market interventions, they continue to suggest that the surface level calm that you have in the credit markets is ignoring something subcutaneous, just under the surface, issues which at least a few banks are more sensitive to. So if you're in the habit of lending overnight and choose not to, what are your reasons?
Do you remember when Bookstopper was on the program and he talked about some of the new regulations? And a lot of times regulation seems to be one of the chief causes of the next crisis. So they'll regulate after a crisis. And then the next crisis, 9 or 10 years later, is actually caused by the regulations. Do you think that some of the regulations, the fear that the banks might have going back to the global financial crisis, factor into them not wanting to loan money in this environment?
I think this observation might be helpful because now you have periodic snapshots, which measure capital ratios, and they're far more of a sensitive issue to manage in this post-global financial crisis regulatory environment. So yes, Bookstopper's right. Dodd-Frank fixes many problems. But now you have a regulatory regime which also creates new pressure points within the markets. Think of it, what the banks did in September, as hoarding. Hoarding by the banks, a certain degree of stinginess as you get to month end, as you get to quarter end, as you get to year end.
Because the regulators are watching.
Exactly. Anytime where there is greater balance sheet scrutiny, than in the in-between times. And so that's where your snapshot's taken, and that's where behavior is going to change. If you know that regulators are going to put you under the microscope periodically, then you change your behavior for those periods of time where the bank regulator is viewing the balance sheet snapshot. Bottom line is this. Bottom line is that regulatory shifts may very well be responsible for the volatility we see in the repo markets, with reserves increasing exponentially to satisfy the new regulatory regime criterion. Stinginess is still a choice. You could operate as you had previously, but the weight of compliance has increased since 2008 and 2009.
Okay, so let's put ourselves in the place of a bank. Okay, do you really need to step in? You know, the Fed's got the back of the market. The Fed's going to provide whatever liquidity you used to, and you get paid interest on your reserves by these guys. That's incredible that they actually pay them to not loan, and they manage that interest rate up and down based on how much liquidity they want to release from the banks. This is that sterilization that we were told about years ago, Dave.
Yeah, and so you've got a part of the issue here, which you're pointing to, is moral hazard, where the banks don't have to do what they've always done or can opt out anytime they choose if they know the Fed's willing to step in. But I think this moves past the point of there being different kinds of reserves. There's some reserves which the banks are required to have, and those are capital adequacy. Do you have enough money if somebody comes knocking and they want their deposits
back? Which is not a bad regulatory requirement.
No. So having minimum level for capital adequacy, great. Then you've got a whole different kind of reserves, excess reserves, which you mentioned, you know, are left with the Fed and they're being paid. Of course, the rate got lowered, I think, to 1.55%. So it's not as generous as it was at 1.8.
But they're still paid to not do anything with their money.
Still paid to not do anything. Exactly.
Right.
But as the weight of compliance has shifted since 2008, 2009, or the aftermath of that period, the net impact is that the Fed gets written into the script more often and with larger amounts of capital just to keep things running smoothly. So we've moved beyond the crisis management stopgap, and now they have an enduring market presence.
It's the training wheels, the training wheels. The Fed has put training wheels on and adjusts the training wheels, but the market's not running on its own anymore.
Liquidity stresses, okay, they show up in the repo market, and what they suggest is that the Fed's not going to be able to shrink their balance sheet. Because remember, the liquidity stresses in the repo market only revealed themselves after the Fed began their attempt to shrink the balance sheet. This goes back to 2018, significant market sell-off Q4 2018, which again revealed a very low level of tolerance in the credit markets and in the asset markets in general for policies that were going to be anything less than accommodative. What are we talking about in the end? We're talking about debt addiction.
Debt addiction.
And the volatile withdrawal symptoms that are here for the duration.
But we still have shock therapy. Dave, shock therapy. Okay, you get those algorithms trading up and down. You're right. We've got debt addiction. But one of the points that you were talking about telltales, and both of us have sailed a little. I don't want to claim to be a sailor, okay? But we had a sailboat for a while. We had a telltale up there, which is the little string. It's the little yarn. We had one also in the glider, the sailplane that I flew. And it tells you what direction the wind is coming from. Sometimes you can't feel it, but you can see that little telltale. Now, the VIX, the volatility index, it's been so quiet, Dave, so quiet. You brought that out last week, the week before.
Right.
You know, and then shock therapy. Boom.
Right.
And yesterday.
VIX measured 11.75 at the low a few days ago.
Yeah.
By midweek this week, it reached 18. That's a 53% increase in a matter of days. What do we say?
Yeah.
What do we say? Just a few weeks ago, we can't tell you how high the stock market might go, but we know how low the VIX goes. It can only go to zero. Mm-hmm. And the closer it gets to a single digit number, it's matching up with every other major market peak and coincides, as it gets to those low numbers, with every major market decline. It tells us a lot about the direction of stocks and the equity market volatility going forward.
Mm-hmm.
What was our recommendation then? What does it continue to be?
Hedge.
Hedge your risk accordingly. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Passive, 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 panic. passive panic. We want to remind the listeners, send your questions in to info@McElvaney.com, info@McElvaney, McElvaney.com. Dave, you're going to get to as many of those questions, maybe all of the questions, as they're sent in. We're going to do that over the next few weeks.
We'll do our very best to answer them. And in the event that there's a question that is well beyond our pay grade, we'll just bring on an expert as a guest in the commentary to address those issues. Every question is important. No question is unimportant. So please send them, and we'll do our very best to answer them.
You've been listening to the McElvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McElvaney. You can find us at McElvaney.com. And that's at McElvaney.com. And you can call us anytime, business hours 8 to 5, at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McElvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McElvaney Weekly Commentary.